So, disturbing emotion. So we were talking about the different kinds of disturbing emotions, or simply from the Buddhist perspective, recognizing, using one's own watchfulness, carefulness, and through that invoking the intrinsic prajna wisdom that is capable of discerning between all those causes and conditions that are powerful in inflicting pain and harm to oneself and to the others, and then joining it with greater courage and insight to be able to eliminate that, uproot it from one's own mind stream. So that would then be how to approach sort of eliminating or abandoning those negativities, disturbing emotions, defilements or kleshas, and instead being able to generate more positive causes and conditions that is a cause of happiness to oneself and to the others. So that is the then Buddhist way of looking at things. Now, coming here, I was thinking about this young person who we knew at that time, a young person, very capable among many of the Buddhist teachers at that time. This young Western man was considered to be one of, what do you say, someone with great potential, great capability. Came from quite a wealthy family, very dynamic in personality, and very quick in learning everything. Good leadership qualities. It almost seemed like all many good things coming together. So among many of the Rinpoches, I often heard, although I never met this person, but I heard of many wonderful things and the potential that this person had. And he picked up on Dhamma very easily. His mind was very, very alert and devoted, humble in his approach to Dharma. Then he came back to the West, and he also began to become very pivotal in bringing many excellent teachers to the West and serving their vision by bringing together many sanghas. And quickly everything around him, because of his leadership qualities, everything was very, very active. Everyone was very inspired. It allowed many teachers to manifest their activities of teaching. And so it seemed very promising. Then there came a certain moment in his life, and he came at a crossroads where he had the choice of either going back to school and studying more, completing higher masters or something like that, or giving it up and continuing to run a Dharma center and serve the vision of the teacher, continue more with his own connection to the path of the practices. Now, that's an interesting situation that very often we encounter in today's times, especially when we deal with a lot of young people who are inspired to engaging in the path of practices. So, personally also, I encounter many times when people say, should I give up school for Dharma? Or should I not necessarily give up anything, but should I take Dharma as the only thing that I am going to be involved in? If the person chooses to be a monk or a nun, then making that decision is very easy, because being able to take on the pratimoksha vows is an excellent way of engaging fully, wholeheartedly with the path of practice. But when it comes to a lay person who wishes to see Dharma as the most important thing, which in some cases would mean that that person would not necessarily finish school, and in some cases, because of that, you may not find high jobs, at least white-collar jobs. You may have to have very simple lifestyle, and you may not even know whether you have the possibility of having a family. If you have a family, of course, your responsibilities, and there is no way that you can sort of just live your own life. You are responsible for other people. If you have children, that responsibility increases even more. So when confronted with that kind of a situation, many years ago, I used to often think, not knowing how much your enthusiasm is going to last, that there should always be a fallback cushion in case that there comes a point where you need to have more money or a career or a house or, you know, all of the other sort of more mundane things. That is very important in the lives of many people. So because occasionally we do come across situations where people have devoted a lot of their days, years to the path of practices, and then somewhere along the line you begin to feel a little bit left out when you find your friends have moved on. They have children, they have families, they've bought a house, they have a car, they seem to have a job. Someone asks you, what do you do? You have a very straightforward answer. I'm a doctor, I work in a bank, or whatever it is, straightforward answer. You ask a Buddhist who's devotedly practicing the Dharma, what do you do? You have no occupation, so to speak, and you can definitely not tell the other person something like, I'm watching the nature of my mind, and that's your sort of occupation or career. And so living in the mundane world and having no labels to put on one's own self discourages many of us on the path of practice. It's not that we are not happy to engage fully to the path of the practices, but designations, labels, having identity is very important in this world. And so where that happens, and in this case, this story is very relevant, is when this young man was confronted with that question, the teacher that he spoke to and from whom I heard this story gave him the advice at that time that perhaps it was better to go back to college, go back and finish a higher degree, since his mind seemed to be a little bit inclined towards exploring that possibility. And so he went to school, he went back to school, he finished all the many years of studies. While at university, he continued to work with the teacher and in the activities of the center as best as he could, coming on weekends, giving up most of his holiday time to the practices, to the activities that were happening. Eventually, he met a girl, and then he again asked the teacher, what should I do? Should I actually marry this person, or should I just concentrate on Dharma? Now, whenever you approach a teacher with the question, should I marry or should I have Dharma? It's a done thing that the answer is going to be marry. Unless the teacher really is an honest person, polite answer is that you would never come with the question if your mind could make up the decision. So most often the question will be, you decide on your own. However, whatever happened, this person met with this woman and he married. And they had a very good marriage, happy, but then he had less time for everything else. Then he had a child, and he became very busy, and he founded a small company, and he founded this company thinking that the resources of that would be then better in stabilizing the financial situation of the Dharma Center. But it doesn't work that way. You get more busy and you get more involved. Eventually, we heard that he had very little time to take away from whatever he was doing. The child he had, the wife he had, the house he had, the company he had, the job that he had. And then this was during the time when the computer business was just picking up. And so everything was becoming very competitive. And of course, he had to concentrate. He was working 18, 19 hours every day. Even the little bits of pieces of practices that he would be able to do, he didn't seem to find much time. And he tried his very best. There were moments, I hear, when he would feel very, very sad about not being able to continue with his path of practice as he used to like doing so before. Then something very sort of dramatic happened. And just as things were sort of picking up in his life, He was diagnosed with a very severe cancer. And the duration between his diagnosis and his death that happened was less than 2 months. Very quick. So the Rinpoche, from whom I heard the story, always says that he regrets actually telling him at that point to go back to school. Sometimes you think back and you think, maybe it would have been better. So I keep that in my mind when I relate to many of our practitioners, whenever they come to that kind of a point where they have to really exert more effort into the Dharma. Because in all our social sort of awareness or samsaric awareness, we do tend to be very cautious. And of course, being cautious with your life, making sure that there are responsibilities that you fulfill. And eventually, it is about what's a priority in your own life. Not everybody will be able to give up everything to completely transform and engage in the path of the practices. However, what I mean to point out is there is really nothing more precious than Dhamma, which has to be understood despite the fact that we are socially aware or cautious of what our status in society is. Everything in life seemingly, apparently, is important. Jobs are important, education is important, relationships are important, and they are very important, especially once you have started it. If you are in a relationship, it's very important. If you have a house that you are paying for it is very important. If you have a family, being very responsible towards your family, towards your partner, is extremely important. But in all of these important things, there is another thing that is extremely valuable, and that is the path of practice, Dhamma in your life. As I said earlier, that does not mean that one has to, at a certain point, make a choice between this or that. That may also happen, but for most of us, it has to work in tandem. In such a way, however, that if not greater, then at least the concentration in Dhamma practice and engagement in Dhamma practice, which requires sincere diligence and discipline in practice, must be always regarded as being very important. Where that is not, the importance of which is not understood, then we will have no other option but to relate to even Buddha Dharma from a very theistic perspective. Theism, in any path of practice, isn't the outcome of somebody who plans it to make it very solid. But theism becomes very prevalent in the minds of those who tend to separate one's living life different, or keep it or place it different from the view of whatever one is believing in. For Buddhist practitioners, particularly, who try to work against or try to engage in a practice where the foundations of the teachings itself teach against making it theistic, it becomes very essential to examine within one's own self and see whether a much more theistic notion is not being sort of cultivated in one's own mind stream, instead of truly engaging and understanding the intent of the Buddha in how to cultivate the teachings in one's own life. So Buddhist teachings is not something to follow or to simply believe in. One can never stop someone from just having a very theistic spiritual idea of Buddhism. Some people do, and if that is inspiring, then that is a different way to approach. But in actuality, how the Buddha taught, how we have received the teachings, and what the teachings teach is not so much about simply an adherence to a belief that broaches more onto the point or level of admiration of a view. But Dharma, as the Buddha intended, as the Buddha taught, must be embodied within one's own self. That embodying of the Dharma in one's own life, where you breathe Dharma, you live Dharma, you exude Dharma. And therefore, when you act, it is a Dharma person, a person who has received Dharma, engaged in an activity. When you speak, it is evident that this is the speech of somebody who lives Dharma. How you think, and particularly the decisions that you make in your life, permeating with the insight of a person who has heard the teachings, adheres to the teachings, meditates and practices and values and believes in those teachings, must be present in every meditator. That is then engaging in Buddha Dharma in daily life, embodying Dharma in everyday life. And when you begin to concentrate and exert diligence and effort into permeating this quality in your body, speech and mind, then one can say one is devoted to the Dharma practitioners. And in such a case, you still continue to be the father, you continue to be the mother, you continue to have a career, you continue to be a monk or a nun, you continue with your jobs and responsibilities, but within the framework of whatever designation that you have given yourself, still there is the fragrance and the resonance, radiation of the illumination of wisdom, of the Dharma permeating within one's own mind stream. That is the aspiration that we all hold. That is the aspiration that we hold, and at the same time it is a potential and a possibility that we all have. And this is then called truly engaging in Buddha Dharma in daily life. Such must happen, such must be generated in the minds of all meditators. This morning we were talking about, and I ended with the 20th affliction of what is called Shijin Meba. Shijin Meba, simply as I went through, translating it as weakened prajna of discernment, weakened wisdom that is able to discern between what to abandon and what to cultivate. Very often this quality that eliminates such a sense of carelessness or lacking in the wisdom of discernment is referred to by translators as cultivation of the quality of vigilance. So the antidote to wisdom of lacking in the wisdom of discernment seems to be said to be vigilance, or developing a vigilant mind. Shijin dan demba in Tibetan, for example, however, would be is an acute observance of how you are reacting and relating to everyday events. And therefore, this afternoon, the main point I'd like you to keep in mind is cultivating Shijin in your life, cultivating this permeating alertness, vigilance, watchfulness in your life, such that the vigilant mind becomes strong enough to withstand disturbing emotions, abandon them if one feels the Hinayana approach of cutting through disturbing emotions is what is one capable of. Mahayana approach, if that is something that you connect to much more strongly, then not only with the vigilance eliminating negative emotions from your mind stream, from your habitual patterns, but strengthening, replacing that with a far superior good attitude, an attitude that is the exact opposite of whatever negativity that is being projected, such that if there is a lot of desire, a lot of self-cherishing, your own self and the senses acutely craving for the satisfaction of its own sensory sort of perceptions, then allowing oneself to immediately change that from with the Mahayana spirit of acute awareness of the needs of the others. So not so much about eliminating only, but on top of not only responding to the familiar impulses of the negative emotion, responding to an unearthing and strengthening a stronger emotion of maybe just as I am feeling this, but how about the others? What does the other person feel like? What about the others? How would the others experience? What would they want? Expanding your mind to the needs of the others. In the same way, where anger is generated, instead of the anger, immediately looking at patience, cultivating tolerance, cultivating sympathy for the others, being able to acutely see the poisonous nature of anger and eliminating it simply because one realizes the uselessness of it, how much dominated by one's own inability to curb the self-cherishing attitude. And therefore, again, the consequences of how much pain it creates in the others, but not only in the others, but the consequences that come back to you also because of not being able to control that emotion at a certain moment. And so in those ways, being able to work with your own self is the cultivation of this vigilance, of this watchful observance in one's own attitude. So bringing that about, relating it to all the negative emotions and transforming it. But also from the Vajrayana perspective, the observance and the vigilance, being able to speak much more directly to you in how your mind begins to again and again create many different deluded concepts that allows you to imagining that every production of all these afflictions that we talked about, whether three root poisons or these 20 emotions or the 51 mental events, all of them are simply the sort of subsidiary projections that all seem to stem from one single cause of the root self-cherishing attitude in one's own self. And so instead of being preoccupied with trying to douse the fire, so to speak, of the afflictions and the negative emotions, immediately taking the almost arising of every negative emotion, all emotions, but primarily the negative emotions, as a way of sort of looking at yourself even more clearly, understanding yourself even more clearly, that kind of a vigilance, knowing things as they really are, the power, the insight, the honest approach of seeing things as they really are, the causes as they really are, rather than falling into the sort of lazy man's attitude. Ignorance, we say. But again, here ignorance becomes a lazy person's attitude of placing the blame on external conditions. And so, for example, if there is a root problem, you get to the root to uproot it so that you can overcome the problem. Instead of uprooting the root problem, if you continue to simply waste time doing many things on the periphery, then the actual problem, the disease being there, it never is able to completely eliminate the problem. In the same way, where the actual problem, the self-cherishing attitude, isn't really caught, isn't really seen for what it truly is, simply working with dousing the emotions, then that is not going to be very helpful, since the sort of ceaselessness of the activities of the senses, you will always have a lot of feeling. You will always have lots of emotions. So if you think, one day there will come a time when in meditation, the emotions will say, oh, enough, I've had enough, I'm going to sever my ties and relationship with you, I'm never going to pop up in your mind again. Now that would be very nice, but it's never going to happen. Feelings and sensations will never cease. I don't know how many times I may have mentioned this, but when we grew up, you know, the great kindness of all our teachers, that they were so patient with us. But as I grew up, now then you're always meditating, and then thinking, so at some point, feelings won't happen. I used to think that way. If your meditation is very good, there will come a time when the feelings will not be a problem, when emotions will not be a problem, when thoughts will not be a problem. If you know the emptiness nature of the thoughts, then somehow the bubble is going to burst and thoughts won't come because it cannot arise in a mind that knows it to be empty. Now, when you think about it in this way, then you wait. You wait, you are a good Buddhist, you are dedicatedly sitting on your cushion, and you think, well, they will give up at a certain point. But it doesn't give up. Thoughts keep coming up, no matter how many times you've read, it's empty in nature. Emotions keep coming up, senses keep coming up, every form is entertaining, and with each entertainment there is a variety of thoughts, judgments, opinions. Every sound comes together with a variety of flavors. With each flavor, you have a particular decision, particular opinion about them. And with each of the senses, whether it is the smell, whether it is the taste, whether it is the texture, whether it is the thoughts of your own self, from the simplest and the most harmless events to the very bigger events and the bigger experiences, each one of them come with it a gamut of experiences, each one of them having different emotions and different feelings, different sensations. And the mind always is very embroiled, very caught up in responding to all the different kinds of feelings and sensations that are there. So very frustrated after a while, thinking, now what's not here? You live with an excellent teacher, you're trying to practice, you also have a name called Khandru Rinpoche, you belong to an ancestry of great beings, but thoughts are not giving up. Emotions are not giving up. So I ran to His Holiness, Jebji Trichen Rinpoche, and then I said to him, feelings just won't stop. And then Rinpoche, always very patient, always very, very humorous, then he said to me, it will, the day you die. So that is something I've kept in my mind all the time, is that, yes, when you die and your dead body is there, then there is no emotion. Dead body has no feeling, dead body has no emotion. So if we are waiting for a time where there will not be emotion and feeling to the body, then wait for death. Corpse will probably enjoy the respite it deserves to be free from thoughts and emotions. Point here is, mind, as long as is luminous, clear, vivid wisdom, awake, its own vividness, its own sort of vivacity, and its own brilliance will always be so brilliant that it is always going to be active. It is always going to be there. Thoughts, feelings, and emotions are radiance of a wonderful mind, of a good mind, of a mind that is alive. So it's going to be there. But it doesn't, that vividness and the absolute brilliance and the clarity of an awakened mind that expresses itself through the pathways of the senses is never the problem. Problem is how we handle that situation. So emotions are not dirty, ugly, distasteful, destructive, or negative. We make it negative, destructive, ugly, hurtful, and a cause of pain. Buddha's entire teachings of the Mahayana path of practice is directed towards the need to understand that. As manifold thoughts as that which arises in one's own mind stream, if there is no participation from yourself in handling them in a negative way, do thoughts, and again, countless of masters have asked that question, do thoughts by themselves have the power of doing or manifesting, producing or constructing anything without participation from your own self? And so in meditation, it is important to look at one's own self and see that. If a thought arises in your mind, you have this enormous power and choice to do what you like with that thought. Like a painter in front of an open new canvas, you can splash it with all kinds of colors. If you splash it with red color everywhere, and then you demand the canvas not to have the red on it, and that's not justified. That's not being understanding of the canvas. Where you do not resist the temptation to paint it red, a canvas will always manifest as red. In the same way, if you splash black on the canvas, or a variety of different colors on the canvas, it is in the same way if you splash that color in your own mind stream. And a thought, a fresh thought in the very cognitive mind, in the very awakened mind arises. But you begin to distort the senses' clear ability to be self-expressive. And the self-expressivity itself is then colored with your own hopes and fears. And the hopes and fears make it into this very strong emotion that we are then trying to get rid of. Then symptom, trying to get rid of only the symptoms is never going to bring about the cessation of the problems. Cessation of the problems will only come when the root from where it is being painted in the color that is being projected is completely brought about to a cessation. So therefore, in terms of the Mahayana teachings, in the Hinayana teachings, but particularly within the Prajnaparamita teachings, it becomes essential for all of us who are trying to work with the process of working in purifying negative emotions or transforming negative emotions or transcending negative emotions to take time for self-observance, to bring about strengthened vigilance, generate stronger wisdom of discernment by engaging in the very sort of simple practice of abandoning negative actions from one's own attitude and conduct. Therefore, as I said earlier this morning, there is no more powerful, more direct teachings than the Hinayana teachings, which talk about abandoning all the kleshas, abandoning what is poisonous and you identify as a cause of suffering for yourself and the others. And so, without, again, sort of needing to make it into a philosophy, as a person who really wishes happiness for all others and wishes for happiness for one's own self, eliminate those causes that bring about harm, that bring about cause of suffering. Eliminate from your own actions negativities such as anger, such as selfishness, such as jealousy, arrogance, ignorance. And you have to do it. And primarily for that reason, I think there is no more a direct instruction of the Buddha than the cultivation of the Eightfold Path. Cultivate right view. Always think good of the others. Period. Right thought. If you must think well. Think kindly. Think patiently. Think for the well-being and the happiness of the others. Empty your mind of any thought other than that which is genuinely good, genuinely kind, genuinely pure. Do not speak, and if you must speak, speak right. Speak good. In the same way, engage in actions that are always good and kind and generous and patient towards the others. Have no livelihood other than that livelihood which is a cause of happiness to the others. Dedicate your whole life and every action that you do, such that you take the slogans of Atishas to your own daily life, victory to the others, loss to one's own self. You live by that motto. And you exert 100% effort, not 99%, 100% effort. And you develop right mindfulness and right concentration such that your mind never wavers. If one were to claim to be a Buddhist practitioner, that's how we should be. And I think we should all try that. Try that, and then you will see what we mean by root cause is something else. Emotions are symptoms. Root is far more intricate than the symptoms. Problem is not the anger. Problem is not the jealousy. Problem is not the arrogance. Problem is not any of the negative afflictions. They are negative emotions, as we discussed about it, but they are not the very fullness of the problem here. They all stem from a mind. What is produced are these different symptoms of neurotic mental patterns. But if you go deeper into it, there is one that is simply a mind that is tremendously grasping to what is called craving and grasping. So the entire life, why the anger is projected, why the desire is projected, why any of these 20 kleshas that we talked about, discursivenesses that we talked about, is projected, is because bottom line, there is a craving, there is a grasping, there is a constant wish to fulfill. Yesterday, I talked about the positing of many different things, factors, in order to sustain an identity that we have. And so in the same light, the craving and the grasping, when you begin to look into your own mind stream, how does it crave? How does it grasp? Why is it grasping so much? Why is it constantly asking for more? Then we find an unsatiating sort of tendency within our own self, that is, the whole antenna is outside, where it can grasp, where it can crave, what it can get in order to protect, in order to build up this ego, this sense of my and me and I within one's own self. And so the Prajnaparamita teachings encourage one to look really into one's own self and see what is this that we build up. In the teachings of the Hinayana, and further then commented upon within the Prajnaparamita teachings, there is the subtle fourth and the fifth Nidanas that we talk about in the context of interdependent links, name and form and the senses. So here too, in really examining that the becoming or the origin of the different emotions are related to the grasping, the craving tendencies. But the craving and the grasping tendencies, if we explore where that comes from, primarily we think senses and the contact of the senses becomes very strong within our own self. Eyes, ears, nose, mouth, our body, and the mind, the six senses. Then the subtle sense consciousness of these senses that are attracted to what are the six sense objects. So we see form, and there is articulation by the sense consciousness of the eyes. In the same way, the mouth, if it tastes something, there is the mouth sense, the tongue sense, and there is the taste that it experiences, the consciousness experiences, because of the subject or any kind of a sense object that it may have partaken. So sense, how it interacts with the sense objects, the bridge between the sense and the sense objects being the sense consciousness, that has to be, again, observed by all meditators. One cannot take the teachings of Prajnaparamita, Mahayana teachings, or the teachings on such as the 12 Nidanas, and simply see it as a mathematical equation. But if one is serious about engaging Dharma in one's own life, wisdom of discernment has to be generated. The 20th affliction of weakened prajna of discernment, to eliminate that, instead to awaken within oneself strong wisdom of discernment, or what we call vigilance here, that vigilance supported by all the methods of meditation, especially in observance of yourself, has to be taken into everyday life. That's the point we are making here. How you take it into everyday life is in those moments that you are relating to in your everyday engagements. When you see things, a meditator must immediately know how you are looking at things. How does your sense consciousness attract itself to a sense object? What kind of a message are you getting? How does it work? Your eyes, the subject that you're looking at, the object that you're looking at, the clicking in of that, and how you're relating to it. When you go to a coffee shop and you're looking at the range of things that you have to choose from, and you go from chocolate chip cookie to some kind of sandwich, to a plain bread, to a cheesecake, or whatever it is, plus you think, oh, I'm on a diet, I shouldn't be eating that. So your mind, your eyes consciousness, sense consciousness is functioning. The whole mechanics of how all the different elements of your body is functioning at that moment has to be acutely observed by a meditator. You begin to learn how you see things and how you relate to that. Today it's a cheesecake, pretty harmless. Tomorrow it'll be your enemy, could be dangerous. Don't jump on the enemy, start with the cheesecake first. It's always a better way to go about small things. But in order to defeat such a big thing as habitual patterns of anger, desire, and ignorance, the basis of knowing the functioning qualities of your mind is very important. When you begin to know and observe and cultivate that observance, not for a day, a week, a year, but every moment of your life, and that is what is called cultivating the prajna of discernment, or calling it vigilance or awareness. Where that is not understood, then you have all these fancy ideas of what is mindfulness meditation. I often hear from you all, not just you all, but many of my other friends, who say, my favorite meditation is mindfulness meditation. I've heard that. Some say, my favorite meditation is compassion meditation or tonglen meditation. Some say, mindfulness is my favorite meditation. And of course, it's all meant in very good sort of approach, so that's very nice. But on the other hand, warning bells always go in my mind, because I keep wondering, what do you mean by my favorite meditation is mindfulness meditation? What does it exactly mean? And then, if it means being in your comfortable shrine room, ringing your gong, having a tape somewhere, playing slowly some of the melodious songs sung by Tibetan masters, and then you have a very nice fancy incense burning, all the lineage masters are behaving and they're all in front of you, and then very peacefully, when you have a lot of time, and then you're a little bit aware of whatever it is that you're aware of at that moment, and you find a little bit of a break from everything that you've done from Monday to Friday. This is a wonderful Saturday afternoon, which you can't go out anyway because it's raining, isn't it? And so, children have decided to have a sleepover somewhere else. Husband is somewhere else, or wife is somewhere else. And you have the whole space to yourself. It's a wonderful afternoon, so you decide to do mindfulness meditation. So everything is very peaceful. Then that's, of course, very nice. It's a break. It's a nice Saturday afternoon. If you call that mindfulness meditation, then again, it is good. Everybody deserves a break. But is it strong enough to uproot thousands of lifetimes of habitual patterns? That is very difficult. Because you'll go out and you'll find a cheesecake. And that cheesecake will be then, just before you say, I'd like that cheesecake, the last piece, somebody else takes it. Then your mind begins to lose whatever it acquired in that quiet shrine room called mindfulness. Watching your mind always is very important. Mindfulness meditation is not just simply observance, but it is going deeper into experiencing and learning great, deeply and very sort of accurately how you are going to react to familiar impulses. If you are not familiar with how you are going to react to familiar impulses, wisdom of discernment will always be left without any methods or supporting qualities, which will have to then be generated in order to cut through the habitual patterns. So simply knowing a problem, in other words, simply knowing a problem is then half the job done by a discerning wisdom mind. It not only should be able to see the problem, discern how it is functioning, but have the power of cutting through habitual tendencies. For that kind of a powerful vigilance, for that kind of a powerful wisdom of discernment, being familiar and the familiarity with how your mind functions, with what kind of reactory behaviors you're going to relate to the emotions as they come up, to the feelings as you experience when the sense consciousness and the sense objects are interacting with one another, then gives you the sort of better situation of knowing how to predict your own personality, your own habitual tendencies. When your own neurotic mind becomes very predictable and you can predict how it's going to react, then the wisdom mind has more chances of being able to bring forth sanity and clarity. Otherwise, eliminating negativities from one's body, speech, and mind is going to always be a feeble attempt to correct yourself, which usually comes in the form of having done it and then having regret, having done it, then having regret, having done it again and then having regret. The actually doing something before the reactory habitual patterns begin to come into place is where the vigilance is able to react and intercede prior to the actions coming in. And for such a strengthened vigilance that is able to cut through habitual patterns to be generated, watching yourself in all occasions is very important. And as I said earlier, just sort of using the example of the cheesecake, to go into such a possibility should always begin, that kind of a training of vigilance should always begin with the most harmless of the situations, where you are not immediately encountering powerful emotions, but every day, day-to-day emotions. Not necessarily in the beginning stages of meditation, not even necessarily trying to work with sort of very strong, impactful emotions, whether they are positive emotions or negative emotions. I think one of the mistakes that many meditators often bring about is you wait to solve a problem until the problem has become really very big. In speaking with the nuns also, I always tell them, especially when I'm away from the monastery or the nunnery for a duration of time, they have a habit of trying to, what they say, out of their love, of course, tell me everything is all right every time I call them. And then you go back, and then they give you about 2 days. Before then, there's a whole lineup of problems, of what didn't actually happen well. Not only you, but everyone else that I know of also does the same thing, east or west, both are the same. So then I always tell them, why didn't you tell me when it happened? Now the situation is out of control. It was if caught in the beginning, it would be a minor issue. Since you've let it be for a long time, it's become very complicated and very big issue. So I always tell them, why don't you tell me when the problem can be dealt with immediately? Or then they say, oh, you were so far away and we have so much love for you, so we didn't want to disturb you. But now, then the disturbance is tremendously big, isn't it? So physically being present with you, their love doesn't decrease, I'm sure. But nevertheless, it almost seems to be like this. So the same kind of example is in our own attitude and sort of path of progress or path of working with our own selves. Is sometimes in meditation, we try to wait transformation or working with our own vigilant mind until we encounter a tremendously big issue. Not to wait for that, but address simple things. You should be able to develop greater awareness, greater vigilance when you are encountering peaceful moments in your life. Rather than only sort of use a spiritual practice to encountering monstrous anger, great big pride, and so on and so forth, which is a good thought, keep the aspiration. But immediately encountering the biggest adversity may be able to, again, sort of not go very well or not be successful very much if there is no training from the very beginning. And the training in the beginning has to be with simple things. Therefore, learning how your senses react, how you react to that moment when the three key factors of your sense consciousness, and the sense objects meet, in moments where everything is fairly harmonious, is very essential. When you go for a walk and you like taking that walk, questioning the whole concept of liking to walk, what instigated that? Who gains satisfaction with this? Is that giving in to a mind that desires more? not doing that, then how does fabrication take place? Now, going for a walk, liking that, is that a much more honest approach? Or resisting the walk because you wanted it, and now your mind does something else, and how does your mind relate to that? Is that more true mind? Was that more true mind? Is doing a better thing? Is not doing a better thing? You'll have to see how you work, how you are responding to situations. When you're having a very simple conversation with another person, observance and vigilance has to be is how you are responding to that person. Are you so totally caught on into the conversation that you have no trace of discerning wisdom? Are you fully submerged into that moment that there is no alertness of how you are relating to it? Or is there alertness enough in that responding to that person's question or statement? Are you expressing yourself honestly? Or is there deception? If you are, for example, somebody says, and you don't, both of you know very well that you don't like this person very well. And so, very much. But then if you say, oh, that person twisted her ankle. And in your mind you think, oh, good. But you say, I'm so sorry for that person. At such a moment, watching yourself react in two different ways. There's an inner reaction and there is an expressed reaction. How are you doing that? Then you catch yourself and you think, oh, I should not think so badly. I'm watching myself. I'm actually not supposed to be generating a negative thought. Now when you correct yourself, then even in the correction, another vigilance saying, was that correction fully engaged in genuine kindness? Or is there some amount of deception even in that? Is there a tendency to bring an agenda even to a kind thought? How am I thinking? Why am I thinking the way I am thinking? Why did I say it in such a way? Was that really true? And if it was not true, what made me not say it correctly? Was it more necessary? Was it really beneficial? Was it not beneficial? In all different aspects of your living life, one must engage in really deepening a very acute sense of observance of one's own self. That is the only way you learn the manifold ways in which your mind functions, how it relates to situation. Because ultimately we're all going to be talking about training the mind. Training the mind, and very invisible mind that cannot be found, and yet we have to bring it from a state of negativity to a state of positivity, to a state of purity. In order to be able to work with that which doesn't have even a substantial evidence of existence, it will become very important to look at all the ripples of the effects of the tendencies in which your own mind functions. And so you begin to really look at sense consciousness, bridging the gap between senses and the sense objects and how you're relating to it. That allows a much more permeating understanding of the root cause from where all the tendencies of habitual patterns are arising. And you find, yes, beyond how the senses work. Senses are very important, sense objects are very important, but in between where the sense consciousness is articulating and bridging the relationship between the senses and the sense objects, there is even a much more deeper sort of a subtler basis from where things seem to be originating. So the problem is not only grasping and craving that arises with the contact of the senses, but there is furthermore what is explained as the fourth nidana, name and form. That there is just a tremendous belief of existence. We do not know what exists. And for Buddhists it becomes even a greater dilemma, because to some degree we have done an examination where we know phenomena doesn't exist as a reality, as an existing entity. We also know, many of us who have received teachings in our life, that if you go into locating and exploring a substantially existing entity called self or I, me or mine. We all know beyond English letters, M-I-N-E or M-E or just the alphabet I, there is really nothing that you can point to and say, that's what I is, that's what me is, that's what self is. You take the S out, you take the E out, you take the L out, you take the F out, then there is nothing that you are actually able to locate and say is self, the existence of the self. But again, there is a firm belief that something exists. And so the stubbornness with which there is a firm belief that we are going to give name, to that name we are going to give a form. I am going to call it me, and I'm going to so stubbornly stick with the idea that it exists somewhere, although no one can point out where it is, but it doesn't really matter. It's going to be there. It's the firm belief that becomes the basis upon which senses function, contact functions, grasping arises, craving arises, and everything is born and expressed. And here in talking about emotions, emotions are born, emotions are expressed, feelings are expressed. So therefore, again, in that analytical meditation and examining of what exactly is it that allows us to then continually create an unceasing amount of causes and conditions that projects itself, that produces eventually emotions such as anger, such as fear, such as hope, such as aggression and so forth, desire and so forth. We begin to go backwards into seeing the firm belief of there being something that is existent, that is very real. And therefore, we find that in the whole philosophy of the Buddhist traditions, there is really no other option for a person to really be able to let go of neurotic behavior, discursive behavior, other than to defeat that notion of the existence of the self. And so sometimes we think, why are Buddhists so obsessed with the principle of shunyata, of emptiness? Why must they prove everything to be empty in nature? You know, starting from pillars and vases to we don't leave anything that is not examined to reveal the emptiness nature. But if you look carefully, there is no other option that can then really bring about the irreversible conviction that there is no need to hold on to something that eventually builds up anger, that eventually builds up selfishness, that eventually builds up such a level of ignorance without really uprooting the firm belief of the existence of something of which we have no idea even. And so, within one's own mind, looking at exactly what do you hope to sustain? You know, you're going around your whole life wanting more. You want more love, you want more possessions, you want more wisdom, you want more ability, you want more potential. Basically, if we sort of were to explain to someone, what do we keep ourselves busy with? Is we keep ourselves busy with wanting more all the time. There is this unsatiating hunger and craving and grasping, where all of our concentration and the antenna is outward, trying to locate things that will best satiate. How many forms are there? That, however, we are never sort of ever going to say, enough, I've had enough forms, I've had enough sound, I've had enough thoughts, or I've had enough attachments, or I've had enough material possessions. The mind continues to look for more. And therefore, if it is searching, what is it that it is searching for? To whose sustenance? For whose sustenance? For what it is that it is trying to always satiate? So when a meditator begins to look beyond the reactory impulses of how we relate, but why we relate becomes a question. Why do we respond the way we do? How does the senses continually respond the way it does? Is because it follows. It's almost senses, sense consciousnesses, and the way it articulates its sort of forms and feelings and different kinds of perceptions is mainly because the senses are the slaves to the dominating master that we believe is there. And the dominating master, has to be, no, you have to know what it is. You have to be able to see whose dictations are you taking each moment of your life. And so when we begin to explore what is it inside of one's own self, what is it that seems to be so greedy that it's never going to be satisfied? How much more will it need? So almost as I was saying, you know, in India, some places where we live have very little water. So what we do is we have these rubber pipes that go to sources of water, and then the water trickles down and you store water in big tanks. So most oftentimes, little monks and nuns are always kept in charge to peep inside the tank to see how filled it is. Is it full? Is it not full? So that example comes to my mind over here. If you are going to always serve and be dictated by the ego mind that keeps saying more, more, more greed, more anger, more hope, more fear, you are adhering as a slave adheres to the master, then occasionally it makes sense to see if the tank of the ego's desires is a little bit filled. Is it totally filled? Is it halfway filled? Is it filled a quarter of its way? How much more life do I have to spend adhering to the commands, to the dictation of this message that my mind keeps saying it needs more, it needs to sustain more? So the exploration, sort of analysis within one's own self is seeing so much message is coming. Message, if you respond to, seems to be in the creation of all these causes and conditions, often negative causes and conditions. Therefore, to be able to see whose voice are you listening to? What is the core factor from where all the impulses are arising from? And then if you really look inside of oneself, if you really examine, not stopping your investigation, satisfied with an answer, with a superficial answer, that it is something. So many times meditators become very tired in that kind of an analysis, and we often say, oh, it's this empty mind. I know it doesn't exist, but it is still very powerful. That's a very superficial investigation. And you cannot be content with just a superficial investigation simply because, you know, you're going to investigate. Your life itself allows you to have an intelligence that is far superior than to be satisfied with that sort of a superficial investigation. I always give the example of people like yourselves who are very careful with everything. I observe people when you go to buy food in the supermarket. And the classic example is when you buy cereal or anything that is in bottles and cans. Most oftentimes, you see people reading the label very carefully. And the more careful you are with your food and your diet, the more observant you are with what you are purchasing over there. So people become very particular about 2% of this, 3% of that, 4% of this, and so forth. So I always say, if a person can be so careful with a cereal box of cereal, you would have to use the same kind of carefulness when your whole life is at stake over here, when the lives of many other beings are at stake over here, when this abject anger, desire, ignorance, jealousy, and arrogance, a cause of just the suffering of samsara itself, is being produced, wouldn't you think that the same person would look at what is it that you are churning out? What is it that you are producing? What is it that you are adhering to your own entire lifetime? And so when you observe, when you look carefully, and when you do not get satisfied or sort of leave content or remain content with half-hearted investigations, but you explore deeper into seeing exactly who's the master over here, then at a certain point you begin to realize that there is actually nothing that can be traced to being an independent master who has to be satiated. And so, when the Buddha and the following masters, whoever has realized this, Then, as Padma Rinpoche himself says, such a realization can be, when anyone finds such a realization, there can be only two reactions. Either that person bursts down in tears at just the immense stupidity of our human life, that adheres to something simply based upon a bubble of imagination, a supposition and an assumption. The other option is, again, Padma Rinpoche says, you could burst out in laughter at the stupidity of a human being that constantly believed in something that never really was there. Buddha himself very kindly simply said, ignorance is the cause of suffering. And so there is no big black gloomy ignorance, as I always say, it's not a big ink pot that is poured over our minds. Ignorance is simply spending an entire brilliant human life adhering merely to a supposition that we are a slave to that which cannot be identified, that which cannot be proven to exist. Nevertheless, we adhere to it as dutifully as any slave would to a master. And in that process, create limitless causes of self-destruction and causes of unhappiness and destruction to the others. Therefore, within the mind of each meditator, as one looks at it, one must come to a point where you are struck in wonderment at the immense inability to really rest peacefully within one's own self. A state of equanimity, which is the very basic fundamental nature of your own mind. That mind which seeks so much the peace and the harmony, that peace and harmony being its own nature, not something that has to be applied over your own mind, but it is its own inherent nature, and connecting to that own inherent nature, allowing it to remain pervasively, that would enable one to then sever the ties with the habitual patterns, bearing the sort of habitual patterns that survive only on the supposition that it must be adhered to. And so that strength of equanimity, finding the pure ground of equanimity within one's own self, becomes very important. When you connect to that state of equanimity, your very basic nature, then the power of that connection with your own basic nature, whether you call it primordial purity, or whether you call it equanimity. From the sutra perspective, the equanimity. From much more the mantra perspective, the state of primordial purity. Two names for the same basis. But when it is that very basic nature that you attune yourself with, then you find that the clicking in, or what is called the unification and abiding within that primordial nature, does give you the ability to then not be so seduced or succumb to the familiar impulses of habitual patterns. But then, as Bodhisattva Charyavatara says, like a flash of lightning in the dark night, stormy dark night, it comes and it disappears again. And then again, you are back to the familiar habits of, oh no, this is again, I'm sure I don't want to be a doormat. I have to have my aggression, my hope, my fear. Everything comes back. And so here what we are pointing out to is two things. The primordial nature, the state of equanimity that does not require these many different cravings and graspings that eventually blossom or fruition into the discursive emotions, and yet the stark reality of how it is our inherent nature, and yet we are so unable to respond, to be able to remain within that without becoming distracted by the familiar habitual patterns. Now, when we see both of these situations, then we begin to realize, therefore it became necessary, starting from Shakyamuni Buddha himself, to all our teachers, how to come up with many different methods of practices that would instill within our own selves the framework, the protection, and the many different skillful means that would allow a person to be able to more easily and without obstacles connect to the very basic fundamental nature within ourselves. So, all the methods of meditation are oriented and designed to be able to withstand the storms of the different habitual patterns and connect rather to the very intrinsic nature. The different kinds of prayers and recitations. And many of you say, why should we recite so much? Why should we read so much? The more you read, the more recitations you do, the more you are equipped with all the different kinds of means and methods that will guard the mind to better able to reach its core fundamental nature of basic awareness and not fall prey to all the superficial sort of ideas that we think are important, that we think are necessary, which are nothing but the callings and the different impulses of an ego-based mind that does not let us really see our own fundamental true nature. Devotion is the same. Different kinds of methods of practices and meditation are all the same. These are all designed with a single purpose, that you are better equipped at being able to encounter all the sort of deceptive tendencies of the habitual patterns and able to more recognize that you could still be the best of the person, best father, best doctor, best practitioner, monk, nun, woman, man, child, whatever, without anger, without greed, without ignorance. And so, however, we don't trust that very much. If we look at our own selves, we often think, yes, I would love to be without anger, but what if someone takes advantage of me? I would love to be without selfishness, but what if that expression of selfishness somehow leads to a point where everyone is getting something, and because I didn't express what I wanted, therefore I'm left without? Our mind plays all kinds of tricks that begins to build up the apprehension that you have to have anger in order to survive, that you have to have attachment in order to make sense of this world. And so that is, again, being sort of caught in and what I call the seduction of the impulses that makes you think it's continuously necessary. Such a state is only reflective of a person who has never spent much more than having a glimpse of one's own fundamental nature. So therefore, in terms of the emphasis of the Mahayana approach of working with disturbing emotions, beginning with generation or continuing with where Hinayana leaves, Hinayana's abandon the afflictive emotion of weakened discerning of wisdom. Pick it up from there and take the Mahayana approach of generating strong vigilance, strong wisdom of discernment that does not look at neurosis and negative emotions, but looks at reactions that you have to the negative emotions and questions, why do you react to the impulses of your own mind the way you do? Was that reaction necessary at all in the first place? What is the consequences of that reaction? And the fundamental question here is, who sends out the message, who dictates the reaction? And you have to find out who's the master here, who's the boss here. If you are responding to something, you have to know what it is that you are responding to. Ultimately, when that investigation leads you to seeing how much of what we believe to be the boss, the core, powerful sort of database from where all the messages are coming from, is actually nothing than a mere thought, then perhaps that person will come to an understanding of what the teachings talk about, deluded perception. How much of a delusion is there in the mind? And not only is there in one's own mind, but it powerfully dominates basic awareness and sanity, building up into this personality, into all the habitual tendencies that inflict so much pain and harm to oneself and the others. So here, then the Mahayana teachings lead to a generation of genuine awareness, genuine sense of how much unnecessary suffering we create for ourselves and the others, the power of deluded concepts, and the delusion so powerful that it becomes the basis of all of our experiences. And not only does that understanding lead to one's own self abstaining from being sort of succumbing into such habitual patterns, but you take it also as a greater understanding of what others and everyone suffers from. Others' anger arises the same way, through delusion, through the same mistaken belief, and the allowance of the dictating, sort of powerful sort of tendencies of ignorance, how all the different causes and conditions of suffering of all other sentient beings are also created. That then changes into a much more sympathetic heart, which allows you to relate to negativities with far more resilience and compassion and patience. And so, how do our great teachers, those who have walked and truly engaged on the path of bodhisattva would have so much patience and tolerance, is because they are able to then see. Yesterday I used the example of seeing it is not the fault of the person, but the stick. The stick is then manipulated by the mind, the nature of the mind being empty. In the same way, they are able to have a far more understanding that where there is pain inflicted, yet it originates from this ignorance. And that ignorance is so very powerfully deluding the mind that where would you then have any kind of anger? How could you have any anger towards a person who has inflicted harm on you? You would have far greater sympathy at the inability of this poor person who is not able to oneself be free from the dominating sort of dictatorial power of the ignorance that inflicts oneself and the others. And so the ability to take in one's own stride all the negativities through compassion arises, through your own understanding of your own mind, sympathy towards your own self of how deluded one has been, how overcome by ignorance one has been. One also recognizes this to be the same troubles, the same challenges faced by the other sentient beings. And it broadens your mind. It allows your mind to hold a bigger perspective rather than the linear perspective to emotions. It allows a much more unfolding of a broader perspective to what we all react to, what we all do. So we begin to have what the bodhisattvas have called each person finding happiness, trying to find happiness, trying to avoid suffering. And in that pursuit, not knowing how much harm they bring to oneself and the others. Where there is so much good-heartedness, yet that good-heartedness often expressed in the most negative of the ways, how can you not have anything but genuine sympathy for all sentient beings who are working so hard in finding happiness and yet are unable to bring about the cessation of that cause which doesn't give them the wanted happiness but inflicts more harm and suffering on oneself and the others. So the Mahayana approach encourages a better perspective and understanding, a far more deeper perspective, not necessarily better than the Hinayana approach, but better in the sense that it gives you a much more acute sense of understanding of how, because of the way you have been relating to these emotions, how it is the same for other sentient beings. So it does develop a far more sympathetic attitude where it is not so much against emotions that a bodhisattva path practitioner is working, but it works more in terms of uprooting the cause of ignorance, the cause which is ignorance, so that the elimination of all the symptoms that ignorance of self-cherishing attitude may be able to be dissolved. So it's not the anger that's the problem. It's the ignorance that believes anger is important. The negative emotion that one is trying to overcome for a Mahayanist is not so much the desire, but it is that ignorance that believes there is a self that generates the desire. And therefore, going to the core, going to the root, if that root itself is explored further and reveals ultimately that there is actually nothing to adhere to, nothing that is substantially existent that has to be responded to, then it allows a lot of relaxation in one's own self, which frees oneself from the very strong sort of supposition that with which you live our entire life, and that is which thinks anger is important, ignorance is important, desire is important, jealousy or arrogance is important. And so the importance of what we have made to be very important, when that itself sort of dissolves, when that itself completely subsides, then the ability to be more responsive to whatever situation as it arises, as well as being able to take everything with a greater sense of friendship, with a greater sense of openness, becomes possible in the meditator. And so the animosity with which you relate to everyone dissolves. The hunger with which you relate to everything dissolves. There is greater wakefulness within oneself that allows one to be more sort of in tune and unified with whatever is arising, which is very essential for all meditators. Where that doesn't happen, then again, of course, every little thing becomes very, very important. Every experience is important. Every feeling is important. Every meditation, every sort of emotion is very important. And so in that linear thinking and in that very sort of concentrated, hungry kind of a hungry ghost-like mind, then every little deterring factor becomes an aggravation. So in order that the linear mind be able to have sort of break down its barriers and experience a far more pliable attitude, it is very important to observe your own self. So this evening, that's what I leave you with, is the commitment and the courage to really observing one's own senses and how you react to everyday events. Changing anger, changing ignorance, that's something that you will always be able to do better. But the key factor is watch yourself. Develop conscious mindfulness and vigilance that observes how you relate to things, how you are working with things. And then the more you observe, then you will begin to find within your own self a powerful question of what it is that is dominating your mind that allows you to feel that you have to respond to it in a certain way. And so watch your mind, watch the way you talk, watch the way you think, question the way you talk, work, and think, and be able to see what makes you think the way you do, what makes you speak the way you do, what makes you react physically the way you do. Who is it that you are trying to appease over here, which makes you react in these different ways? Whether it is good and happiness, whether it is bad and negativities. But ultimately, there must be a powerful source that you are listening to because of which you are reacting to it. In order to come up with that question that leads you to better exploration, watching yourself is very important. So, watch yourself, be vigilant, and then I'll see you tomorrow morning and see how you're doing.